Morning. I know what you're thinking. Right now, all of you are asking yourselves the following fundamental question. Why in the world is a physician delivering the morning sermon today? Why listen to him when there should be a real minister up there? In short, just who is this guy? In response, first allow me to say that I am so grateful to speak today, surrounded by new friends, especially our charismatic and most persuasive leader, Reverend Walton. I can personally vouch for the Reverend's most persuasive character, because he's the one who persuaded me, against all odds, to deliver this sermon. I'm a medical doctor who is trained in multiple fields and has cared for patients for over 30 years. In addition, I'm a former state and federal health official and also a Harvard professor, grateful to be surrounded today by some wonderful colleagues from Harvard University. And most important of all, I'm a proud husband, father of three, and a new grandfather. My wife Claudia, my daughter Katie, my son-in-law Zuri, all physicians are here today, as well as my new granddaughter Caroline. In short, as summarized in that beautiful song, Guantanamera, I'm just a man who is trying to do some good before dying. As we reflect on this first Sunday of Lent, we can reaffirm that we all treasure health, not just for ourselves and our family, but also for our community, our nation, and our world. Unfortunately, however, dramatic challenges threaten our collective well-being daily. Challenges such as poverty, violence, cancer, heart disease, tobacco dependence, obesity and malnutrition, pandemics, mental health disorders, just to name a few. Here in the US, we have the highest healthcare costs in the world without the outcomes to match. Too many are dying from opioids, suicide, and other so-called diseases of despair. Too many struggle to receive the compassionate care they need and deserve. In short, we must find better ways of healing so that everyone can reach their full potential for health. Over the years, two powerful statements from the World Health Organization, the WHO, have animated my career. The first reads, quote, "The enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of health is one of the fundamental rights of every human being," unquote. This statement is so profound and so timeless that it is engraved in six languages into the concrete of the exterior of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. When hearing this statement, each of us can immediately ask, am I enjoying the highest attainable standard of health? If the answer is yes, thank God. But if the answer is not yet, why not? And what can we do to improve health for ourselves and others? Helping people reach their highest attainable standard of health is what the field of public health is all about. Which brings to mind the second WHO statement. It defines health as, quote, "a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity," unquote. What does that mean? It means health is much more than what affects the body or any body part. It's also about the mind, the spirit, and the soul. It's a precious and fragile gift. For too long, the worlds of medicine and spirituality have been kept apart when addressing critical issues of sickness and health. But as far back as Aristotle, so many have noted that the soul is, quote, the full actualization of a person, incorporating the body, purpose, and ultimately the sum of everything that is part of being human, unquote. Integrating these two worlds, health and spirituality, moves considerations of health beyond what is tangible to that which is intangible. It helps us touch what we can't see and grasp what we can't feel. It helps us support people yearning to reach their highest attainable standard of health. So healing can and should involve, in addition to medical professionals, anyone who can help people rediscover strength through their spirituality. When we move beyond the unseen, when we move beyond the seen to that which is unseen, we can feel the power of today's scripture in Corinthians, which notes, the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal and have everlasting life. One definition of spirituality states that it is, quote, a dynamic and intrinsic aspect of humanity through which persons seek ultimate meaning, purpose, and transcendence. It can be experienced through relationship to self, family, others, community, society, nature, and the significant or sacred, unquote. Attention to such soul considerations should take place in traditional religious settings, such as this one, especially since landmark research from the Harvard Chan School of Public Health links regular religious service attendance to better health outcomes. But attention to soul considerations can also take place in less traditional settings, such as the home, the workplace, in the community, and yes, in a health setting. Soul considerations shape who we are and how we live our lives. It helps us focus on what is ultimate, not what is merely important. My parents, immigrants to this country from Korea, were the first to teach me about meaning and purpose. Even when I was a young boy, they would lecture us that their journey to the United States was worth it, but also required perseverance and sacrifice. My late beloved father urged us to always see the big picture and resist the temptation to become narrow in our view of the world. One of his favorite sayings was, "Be broad like the sky." My wife and I have since tried to pass these teachings on to our own children. My father's words stay with us always. And over the years, many have served as powerful teachers regarding how soul considerations apply specifically to health. A major figure in that regard was the late Yale chaplain, Reverend William Sloan Coffin. In his sermons, he often railed publicly about how medical care dehumanized patients. He reminded us that patients were first human beings who just happened to be patients and not the other way around. He warned us that, quote, doctors shouldn't view patients as an uninteresting appendage to an interesting disease, unquote. Reverend Coffin drove this point home even further when I heard him speak at Medical Grand Rounds, a formal educational venue usually reserved only for health professionals. At the time, I was a Yale medical student, and I was shocked he was even there at all. I remember wondering, why in the world is a minister speaking at a medical conference? Just who is this guy? But Reverend Coffin, well known as an irreverent reverend, electrified us with an emotional description of his bout of pneumonia that nearly caused his death. He recounted that while sick and miserable in the hospital, he was also overwhelmed by the jolly radiance of overconfident physicians looming over him. He warned us that, quote, "health is oppressive if you haven't got any," unquote. He also emphasized that medical students were first human beings who just happened to be medical students, not the other way around. While at the time, we medical students were all completely obsessed about the need to master facts and medical knowledge, he emphasized that those intellectual skills rarely translated into us becoming good healers. While our mind could be honed to reach magnificent heights, it was still only a tool. It was the full heart, not the keen mind, he said, that was the essence of being human. In an Ivy League milieu, where intellectual cleverness always reigns supreme, this message was revolutionary. By the way, since Coffin was at Yale, not Harvard, his messages may not necessarily apply here. Bill Coffin and I went on to become lifelong friends, something I will always cherish. Another teacher for me was Father Henry Nouwen, who I once heard speak at a college seminar, also years ago. He reflected on the fragility of life and the evanescence of the moment. He noted that vulnerability, often viewed as a weakness, was rather what makes life so precious. For example, it's the utter vulnerability of my beautiful new granddaughter, Caroline, who makes all of us put down our guard, drop all our defenses, and simply marvel at the wonder and promise of new life. In reflecting upon the impermanence of things that only heightens our appreciation for them, Nouwen concluded, quote, "That's why I don't like plastic flowers," unquote. Nouwen also specifically addressed soul considerations for health by focusing on wounded healers. Nouwen quotes a Talmud story that says, while everyone else unbinds all their wounds at the same time and then binds them all up again, the wounded healer only unbinds one at a time, knowing he or she might be needed. Wounded healers also use their bandage wounds to listen to the distress in another's spirit and soul. Often that means just being present with someone in a time of need. He writes, quote, "Simply being with someone is difficult because it asks of us that we share in others' vulnerability, enter with him or her in the experience of weakness and powerlessness, become part of uncertainty, and give up control and self-determination. And still, whenever this happens, new strength and new hope is being born," unquote. I never got to know Father Nouwen personally, but years after his death, his writings inspire me daily. My last story is current and deeply personal. It's about a precious cousin in my extended family. She gave me permission to share her story today. A number of years ago, viral cardiomyopathy, severe weakness of the heart muscles, left her barely able to work or function. Her doctors concluded that only a heart transplant could restore any sense of normalcy to her health. She joined a waiting list for a new heart. Her long wait included 4 months in the hospital. Her medical team and her family all had her best interests in mind and prayed for a donor heart. But as she waited, thoughts about a heart transplant evoked in her not joy, but rather terror, fear, and panic. She told me, "I only wanted my own heart, not anyone else's. She asked herself, is my heart my soul? If I have the procedure, will I become a different person? What will my essence be? She was reluctant to share these unsettling feelings with her medical team because they might feel she wasn't grateful for a chance at a new life. And she didn't want to further burden her beloved family who had already suffered so much with her. So she ultimately confided in several hospital chaplains. One of them ended up visiting her every day, 6 days a week for 4 months. The chaplain focused not on her heart, but rather her soul, paying attention to how she was feeling, nothing else. She brought readings, poetry, quotes, shared communion with my cousin, prayed with her, and accompanied her on a journey that was literally soul-searching. Over time, the process ultimately helped my cousin calm her fears by understanding that the heart is not just an organ, but rather a gift arranged by a higher power between her and another person. As explained by one of her doctors, it'll only happen when it is right for both of you. By the time the transplant occurred, my cousin had found peace, acceptance, and trust that there was a plan. After 17 long months, she received her new heart and is forever grateful to her organ donor for the gift of a second chance at life. And a decade later, at family gatherings, I always love hugging her and hearing how she is feeling about her renewed health. She always teaches me. And when I think of her, I think of today's scripture from Isaiah, because she can now walk and not be faint, run and not grow weary, and soar on wings like eagles. In summary, on this first Sunday in Lent, I hope some of my reflections can be a source of healing for you. I hope all of you can be broad like the sky. I pray all of you can enjoy the highest attainable standard of health. And I hope that viewing soul considerations as an integral part of healing and well-being lifts all of us to be better ministers of health. Because when it all works, we get to enjoy the miracle, the absolute miracle of an absolutely normal, healthy day. Thank you, and God bless you all.